This week on 51%, we're taking a global perspective.
I guess in some way I feel stupid for thinking others would care about my country's history as much as I do.
Facts, and which facts matter. Plus, transforming economies and death-defying press coverage. I'm Susan Barnett, and this is 51%, The Women's Perspective. Noelle Carmichael is an American in Africa. She moved to Tanzania after recovering from cancer, determined to change her life. She certainly succeeded. But while working to improve nutrition for children in Africa, she's also learning things about herself and about what we as Americans take for granted. As we settle into a new year, she's got a viewpoint worth hearing.
And once again, I'm forced to confront the fact that my view of the world is nothing more than simply my personal view of the world. No more than my singular East Coast American public school educated view of the world. Here's what happened. I was engaged in the most intense form of learning new things, teaching. Our school is an international school. I believe there are about 30 different nationalities and languages represented in a student body of less than 200. I was teaching a unit on modern dance to my eighth grade students. I had chosen to focus my lessons on the work of choreographer Alvin Ailey. We began to dissect a piece from what is likely his most famous work, Revelations. The piece, Sinnerman, is a powerful, athletic male trio danced to an up-tempo version of an old slave spiritual by the same title. So after watching the piece a few times and discussing the movements and the emotions of the piece, I started to focus with the students on the context of Ailey's work, both the content of his focus, namely American slavery, and also on the context of Ailey working as a black American choreographer in 1960. About two sentences in, it became clear to me that most of my students were hearing this information for the first time. And not only that, some were defiant that societal evils like slavery and segregation could even exist in the amazing United States. A Russian student informed me that she was unaware that there had ever been slavery in the United States. I was in shock. Needless to say, the remainder of my lesson became a history lesson, and Alvin Ailey was, for the moment, put aside. At lunch that day, I was discussing this experience with my colleagues, and the response of one of them was, "Well, why should they? Why should someone who grew up in Russia or Rwanda or Pakistan understand American history?" I retorted from the lunchroom soapbox that although, yes, these events are part of the history of a specific country, America, they are also important to the whole world. Other countries were invested in and impacted by the end of American slavery. The American Civil Rights Movement served as an example for many other societies grappling with similar issues. As such a powerful country in the world, major events in our American history affect the whole world. Many of my teaching colleagues respectfully disagreed. That evening, I tested my theory again, this time on a German friend, twice my age, who is very well read in history. He also was not surprised that none of the students in my class had knowledge of these major events in American history. He also agreed with many of my colleagues that as an American, the events may be crucial to my understanding of myself, but that each people have their own events of such caliber. To prove his point, he rambled off half a dozen other major cultural revolutions from various countries around the globe, asking me how much I knew on each. I quietly sipped my glass of wine and nodded. His point had been made. Some of them I knew very little about. Some of them I had never even heard of. And each of them, he says, are likely as important to world history as the American Civil Rights Movement. I have continued to bring up this debate with many I have encountered over the last week or so. It has become a little bit of a mental obsession. I have started trying to figure out why this is bothering me so much, and I've realized that it feels like another little death inside of me. These are events by which I define not just my Americanism, but my humanity, my values, my general understanding of the trajectory of the human creatures on this planet. And now I'm supposed to accept that these same events are somewhat insignificant to most of the creatures on that planet? I guess in some way I feel stupid for thinking others would care about my country's history as much as I do. Another part of me still feels that it is really important for generations who are growing up worshiping the land of the free and the home of the brave to at least have some general knowledge about the struggles the people of that land have fought to become that beacon. I don't know that I'll ever shake that view, nor do I think I should. I guess my understanding has just expanded once again. In some sense, I will have no choice but to return to the classroom and teach this history. Any art form can best be understood in its context. Without a general knowledge of Black American history, the works of Alvin Ailey will forever be missing an important part of their power. But I now need to approach this history with new perspective, giving it the weight it deserves in its own place and time, but nothing more. My students' ignorance has brought me more in touch with my own.
Noelle Carmichael lives in Tanzania. Food is a global issue of key importance. The U.S. is the world's leading corn producer, and that corn is in demand in countries with growing middle classes like China and India. They rely on Midwestern grain to feed their livestock as the demand for meat grows. Amy Mayer reports for Harvest Public Media that grain won't meet the needs of the 9 billion people expected to be on the earth by 2050.
World Food Prize laureate and former international aid worker Catherine Bertini applauds bipartisan efforts that have refocused American food policy on farming. She spoke recently at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln.
The administration now, for the first time in a long time, decided, yes, it's a good idea to put more effort into agriculture development.
That means helping all farmers succeed, not just distributing food to the hungry. Governments, nonprofits, and private businesses all have a place in the effort. Seed companies, for example, are developing technologies specific to regions all over the globe. Mike Vandelaar, the chief operating officer of Winfield, a Land O'Lakes subsidiary, says advances in seed technology can have global impact, and the biggest players know to innovate locally, wherever that is.
Generally, the most productive genetics are the ones that are developed within the area where the plant breeding has been done.
If your target market is China, he says, set up a lab there. And eventually, the technology will help Chinese farmers increase yield. Bertini says the U.S. government's Feed the Future program, a commitment to help ensure the world has enough to eat, emphasizes local food production. In places where people are hungry, the program supports small farming efforts because those have a ripple effect.
The World Bank says that agricultural productivity is 2 to 4 times as effective as any other productivity in alleviating poverty.
Today, the world's growing population relies on a combination of international trade, food aid from the rich countries to the poor as needed, and increased local production.
I have two high tunnels, and we use one of them for tomatoes and then the other one for
cucumbers. We need to produce as much to feed the world as we can, but also people like to eat local, locally grown foods too. So. There's a case for both sides of agriculture.
That's Boone County, Iowa farmer Greg Reinhart. This greenhouse-like high tunnel extends the growing season for some of the vegetables and fruit his family grows on 100 acres and sells at farmers markets. But on 700 acres, they grow traditional row crops.
Once we sell it, though, we don't actually know exactly where it's going, but
we know it's not being wasted. It's being used somewhere in the food chain, whether in the United States or it's being exported to many countries in the world.
Given the rich soil and well-developed infrastructure here, Midwestern farmers are likely to continue playing an important role on the world food scene. But Iowa State University economist Bruce Babcock says the goal of domestic production around the world isn't as far off as many people seem to think.
The overwhelming supply of calories and food that is consumed in most countries comes from the country that is the consuming country.
So the persistent challenge is distribution. And even rich countries haven't figured out how to get food to everyone who needs it. I'm Amy Mayer, Harvest Public Media.
That report comes to us from Harvest Public Media. Coming up, from breadbasket to oil exporter, a societal transformation, plus the risks of reporting the truth. If you missed part of this show or want to hear it again, visit the 51% archives at WAMC.org. This week's show is number 1226. In Iraqi Kurdistan, a familiar transition is playing out. Once a lush agricultural region, the area now buys its food from elsewhere and trades in a more profitable commodity, oil. War News Radio's Amy DiPiero has more.
In the 1950s, Iraq was a major exporter of wheat, and the Kurdistan region was the center of its agricultural sector. That order ended when Iraq began to rely more heavily on oil production.
As the Iraqi state petrolized its economy, it became what other rentier states say, a food importer.
That's Denise Natale, the Minerva Fellow at the Institute for National Strategic Studies at National Defense University in Washington, D.C. A former information officer for the U.S. Office of Foreign Disaster Assistance, she first traveled to Kurdistan in May 1992, and conducted independent research in the Kurdistan regions of Iraq, Turkey, Iran, and Syria from 1994 to 2005. Natale says this trend toward a rentier economy, one in which the government exports oil and uses the royalties to import food and most other commodities, is unlikely to change.
I don't know of a case where oil economies have turned back and developed their agricultural infrastructure. I don't see it. Iraq hasn't done it.
But in the long term, what's the effect of developing oil over other resources? In many ways, Kurdistan's wealth and poverty can only grow, quite literally, from the ground up. The story of oil and agriculture, how oil propels the region's economic growth while village farmers make a subsistence living, is the story of Kurdistan's successes and failures. In the big picture, it may also affect the unity of federal Iraq. Here's a more local perspective on agriculture.
Our host took us down into his orchard, and we walked around for hours. We walked through all of these amazing apple trees, and there were pears and quinces, and just kilometer after kilometer of just gorgeous fruit.
Rachel Stacy is a member of the Christian Peacemaker Teams, a service organization based in Chicago, which visited impoverished villages in the Kurdistan region of Iraq during October 2011. In one village, they stayed with an Assyrian Christian farmer who simply couldn't find a place to sell his crops.
Eventually, our host broke the news to us that there isn't a market for his fruit. That really describes the reality, the economic reality of this region, where a lot of produce is much cheaper when it's imported from Turkey or from Iran.
Natale says the rising cost of food is a consequence of the Kurdistan regional government's policies, which seek to bring foreign firms into the region rather than bring crops out to market. But when wealthy firms, not just those owned by foreigners, but by expatriates and locals, do business in Kurdistan, prices rise for everyone.
Why is the cost of living increasing? You've got international businesses coming in, you've got oil companies coming in, you've got hundreds of people, internationals coming in, needing housing, driving up the housing market, the rental market.
According to Natale, this foreign demand removes incentives for the KRG to invest more evenly. Rather than generate other sources of revenue, She says the KRG relies on sign-on bonuses the federal government in Baghdad earns from oil firms and other developers. While this money often funds legitimate development projects like education and infrastructure, Natalie says a lack of budget transparency means that only a limited slice of the population, usually those with a personal connection to KRG officials, reaps the benefits of investment. Additionally, the KRG spends much of its revenue on
jobs. It's 76%. 76% of the public sector, now it's public sector salaries of the budget. That's huge.
So even though the KRG does not provide food subsidies or directly employ Stacey's Assyrian host,
he does get funds from the government, from his Kurdish government.
But overall, Natalie says these subsidies are meager in comparison to the dividends reaped by a few influential interests.
There has been, a concentration of wealth in certain families' hands, in certain political parties' hands. But now, just the oil rents have just allowed it to quadruple in strength.
New agricultural policies might narrow the divide between those who receive oil royalties and those who do not. In a 2011 pamphlet, Kurdistan, Invest in Democracy, KRG Minister of Agriculture and Water Resources Jamil Haider outlined a five-year plan for the farming sector. It mirrors the KRG strategy for developing oil: attract foreign firms and let them bring modern techniques and machinery. But Rachel Stacey feels ambivalent about foreign intervention in Kurdistan's agriculture, noting that many species of plants native to Kurdistan are no longer farmed there.
Most of the seeds that people are planting are the cucumbers and the tomatoes and the onions that we see in mass quantities in our grocery stores.
At the same time, she's a proponent of adding foreign expertise to local knowledge.
What would it mean to offer bits and pieces that we know around permaculture or growing rates or water conservation?
But before the KRG looks for agricultural partners in the international community, it will need to resolve oil disputes with the federal government in Baghdad. Natalie says the KRG has neither the financial independence nor the physical infrastructure to transport the goods.
You can scream that you want independence, but who's paying your bills? The Kurds have 95% of the Kurds' revenues come from Baghdad. Who controls the pipeline? Not the KRG. Baghdad does.
Further still, Natalie suspects the need for oil will soften the KRG's will to compromise on territorial disputes and federal funding for Kurdistan's army, the Peshmerga.
I've been saying this for years. They will cut a deal.
In the interest of preserving federal Iraq, a deal could mean the KRG ceding some disputed territory to federal control in exchange for greater authority over resources. Whether any hypothetical governance change would also bring in Assyrian farmers' pears and quinces to market remains an open question. For War News Radio at Lodge 6, I'm Amy DePiro.
Amy DePiro brought us that report courtesy of War News Radio. Freedom of the press is something we take for granted. In Colombia, however, reporting the news could get you killed. Journalist Lederman Ortiz Berrio in September reported he'd learned of a plot to assassinate him. He's been reporting on criminal gangs, kidnappings, and extortion in a country notorious for its organized crime. Nadia Drost of World Vision Report has more.
Following Lederman Ortiz around his hometown of Caucasia is hard work. Not only does he walk everywhere in this city of 100,000, he walks fast. Barely keeping up with him are two plain-clothed police bodyguards. Their feet get a break whenever Ortiz stops to greet someone he knows. And that seems to be just about everybody.
Hola, ¿cómo está?
Today, Ortiz is off to report on flooding that has inundated a big swath of Caucasia. We arrive at an impromptu dock, a sidewalk where residents are hiring canoes. As we're waiting for our gondolier, a man begins to shout.
Every town in Colombia gets attention, except for Caucasia, because there's no journalist here brave enough to say, look, we're drowning.
Ortiz tells him he's a journalist, and when he mentions his name, The man's jaw drops.
Mucho gusto, yo soy Lederman.
Pleased to meet you, I'm Lederman.
You're Lederman?
The man says he's thrilled to meet Ortiz and thanks him for all that he and his paper do for Caucasia.
It's a great newspaper because it tells the truth. The other journalists are too scared to tell the truth.
Lederman Ortiz is 37 years old. When he was 24, he started publishing La Verdad del Pueblo, The Truth of the People. It's pretty much a one-man operation, headquartered in the house he shares with his mother and nephew. Ortiz drops a stack of past issues on his desk. He prints 2,000 copies every month or two and sells out every time.
A mí me gusta investigar mucho todo lo que es corrupción.
I like to investigate anything having to do with corruption and crime. I expose social injustice. Because of this, the gangs don't like me. I'm their target.
Ortiz pulls up an anonymous email he got a week earlier.
Él quería que mataran a usted.
The message warns him that two of his friends are scheming to kill him, as is the policeman who supervises his bodyguards. Ortiz doesn't know if he can trust the unknown sender, but the message makes him nervous.
Cuando nombraron unas personas que son mis amigos.
When he named people who are friends of mine, it made my head hurt. The next morning, it made me cry.
Ortiz knows he can't ignore the warning. Three times, he says, hitmen have tried to kill him. The first was in 2008, when he was working for the mayor. He'd publicly denounced the alarming security situation in Caucasia in front of Colombia's national police chief. A couple days later, he had a strange feeling and left work early. That afternoon, a co-worker called him and said armed men had just burst into his office looking for him.
When I got home, I held my mom close and I cried because it got into my head, an image I couldn't erase. I imagined myself sprawled on my desk with all my colleagues dead.
The police assigned him a bodyguard, but there's only so much a bodyguard can do. One night last year, after Ortiz reported on a gang-related grenade attack, a grenade exploded at his house while he slept.
At that moment, I didn't feel scared. I felt rage. I punched a pillow and I said, "Those jerks, where are they?"
After the attack, Ortiz was given a second bodyguard. Still, it's too risky for him to go to bars or parties. Some of his friends avoid him. So do potential girlfriends. At night, Ortiz takes me to a dark street corner where last year a hired killer came on a motorcycle to assassinate him, but at the last second decided against it.
¿Qué pasó? Un milagro de Dios.
Ortiz calls it a miracle from God, but the hitman, nicknamed Cockroach, confessed to police that Ortiz's bodyguards had been standing too close to give him a good shot. The bodyguards are with him tonight in their usual positions. One 3 feet behind him, the other across the street. Their eyes are constantly darting, and each rests a hand on a pistol, lodged in the back of his pants. Ortiz sees me watching them and laughs. "You're scared," he says. I tell him, "I'm just watching out." "You're so scared," he says. Ortiz doesn't like to let on, but he can get scared too. But he says he can't let that feeling keep him from doing what he needs to do.
"I don't do this as a hobby, but because of a conviction that I have, journalism for me is more of a calling than a profession."
Since I last saw Ortiz, he's been given a car and two specially trained bodyguards so he can continue reporting more safely. But he may not be a journalist for long. Friends and readers have urged him to run for mayor this fall, and he's decided he'll do it. Running for office in Colombia can be a very risky business. But that's nothing new for Lederman Ortiz. For the World Vision Report, I'm Nadia Drost.
That story came to us from the World Vision Report. And that's our show for this week. Thanks to Katie Britton for production assistance. Our theme music is by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. If you'd like to hear this show again or visit the 51% Archives, go to our website at wamc.org. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll be back next week with another edition of 51%, The Women's Perspective.